We must take upon ourselves a smaller pain in order to survive. I was too young then, and too overcome with illness to realize that the agony he spoke of was not smallpox. But his words weren't madness, and they stayed with me long after the fever had passed. Even now, they help me understand why my father felt the need to rip us from our home and hasten away with such urgency. It pained him to leave Monticello, but what would have survived of him if he'd stayed? Chapter 4. Ampt Hill, 26 November, 1782. From Thomas Jefferson to Chatelieu. Before the catastrophe that closed this summer, my scheme of life had been determined. I'd folded myself in the arms of retirement and rested all prospects of future happiness on domestic objects. A single event wiped away my plans and left me a blank I had not the spirits to fill. In this state of mind, an appointment from Congress required me to cross the Atlantic. My only object now is to hasten over those obstacles which retard my departure. After 3 months of searching every brine-scented port in the colonies, Papa couldn't find a ship willing to undertake the perilous winter voyage through waters filled with enemy vessels. And more than a few ship captains muttered darkly at my father's persistence, wondering if he was a man chasing after an icy death. It shames me still that I cannot say they were wrong. Indeed, I feared they had exactly the right of it. We'd left Polly and Lucy with Aunt Elizabeth at Eppington, and though I missed my sisters, I was glad they didn't have to witness this latest manifestation of Papa's grief. While my father no longer stared down his pistols in the dead of night, he braved the brigand-infested roads with a recklessness that terrified me. I'd wondered if I'd been wrong to keep Papa's secrets. I wondered if I ought to have confessed the full breadth of my fears to Mr. Short the day he came upon us in the woods. But now there was no one to whom I could turn, for Papa kept us always moving from city to city. Everywhere we found brown and red brick buildings squeezed close together, jostling carriages on snow-covered cobblestone streets, docks burdened with goods waiting to traverse safe seas, and mobs of people. The cities of the new states blurred one into another, until we returned again to Philadelphia, where bells rang and celebrants gathered around great bonfires blazing orange in the streets, in celebration of the news. Peace with Great Britain had been achieved. A provisional treaty had been signed, and when I heard, I tugged on Papa's sleeve from my place beside him in the carriage. "Then the war is over?" "Nearly," was his soft reply. After so great a struggle, so many harrowing hours and devastating losses, I thought Papa would be overjoyed at our victory. But he received the news with reserve, chagrined to learn that peace was made without need of his negotiations. I've come to believe that he hoped to regain his honor by ending the revolution he'd helped start. In his guilty grief, he counted my mother as a casualty of that war, and felt robbed of his chance to ensure her loss was not in vain. But at the time, I thought the cause of Papa's melancholy was because we wouldn't be going to Paris after all, and he didn't want to go home. Indeed, he seemed to think of every possible excuse to delay, even contriving a visit with our Randolph relations at Tuckahoe. I wondered if in this there was an opportunity. The Randolphs were Papa's people through his mother, and he'd spent his childhood on Tuckahoe Plantation. Some part of me hoped the Randolphs would be able to see behind the cool blue veneer of my father's gaze to the dark abyss I still saw. No one at Monticello had the authority or audacity to question Papa, but I knew Colonel Randolph would have no such qualms.
"You'll be glad to see Colonel Randolph, won't you, Papa?"
I asked as the carriage jostled along on the long, narrow drive to Tuckahoe, under a foreboding canopy of trees. The drive was so narrow, in fact, that if we veered even a little, our wheels would get stuck in the mud.
"He's a good man," Papa said,
which is what he always said about Colonel Randolph, for the two men had been raised together as boys by my grandfather when he was custodian of Tuckahoe. Yet, even now, I cannot imagine a less likely candidate for my father's friendship than his childhood companion, Colonel Randolph. Where Papa projected a calm, composed demeanor, the Colonel was a militant man, marching impatiently along the white-painted fence in front of his riverside home, barking out his welcome to Tuckahoe Plantation. Where Papa wore a gray homespun frock coat with wooden buttons, we found Colonel Randolph clad in formal dress, colorful as a Tory in a crimson coat and matching embroidered waistcoat. And whereas Papa was the author of our independence, Colonel Randolph was decidedly conflicted about the revolution.
"This damned war,"
he spat, when my father shared the happy news of a treaty.
"The inability to ship tobacco overseas has brought my finances into a very low state. Now I'll have to pay a fortune on it in customs duties."
"The price of liberty," Papa replied with a tight smile. Colonel Randolph grunted, waving us into the dark-paneled entryway of his abode.
"I fear liberty has impoverished us."
It was a boast cloaked in modesty, much like his wooden plantation house itself. At first glance, Tuckahoe looked to be a modest white-painted house with two chimneys, but circling round the drive revealed it was really two houses connected by a central block, like the letter H. The rear of the mansion was dedicated to entertaining guests in high style, complete with salons and a great hall, which gave the lie to the idea that the Randolphs were in any way impoverished. A veritable army of well-dressed house servants carried our luggage up the ornately carved walnut staircase, while I drifted into the parlor, entranced by mirrors and polished rosewood and mahogany, every piece so splendid I was afraid to touch. The only thing to mar its beauty was the damaged paneling over the fireplace, and as I stared at it curiously, Tom Randolph, the eldest of the Randolph children, happened upon me.
"The British came searching for your father during the war. When we wouldn't give him up, Tarleton ripped our coat of arms from the wall."
"Your coat of arms?" I asked.
"My ancestors were great lords in England and Scotland,"
Tom said, showing me a leather-bound book open to a page of what looked to be heraldry.
"My people were amongst the first families of Virginia, better than yours."
Tom was just an over-eager puppy then. If I forget the wolf he became, I can still smile at the memory of the 14-year-old boy, tall and lanky, with brown hair and eyes so dark they appeared almost black. Given his imperious pronouncement about his lineage, I felt as if he expected me to curtsy. Instead, I said,
"We're kin, Tom. Your people are my people, too."
"But I'm also part Indian," he countered, making of his face an amusingly savage scowl. "That's why I'm an excellent horseman. I'm descended of Pocahontas. Are you?"
"I don't think so," I replied, for I was certain Papa would have told me if we had any direct relation to the famous native princess. "But we display buffalo robes at Monticello." A hint of genuine curiosity shone in Tom's black eyes.
I'd like to see those. Those savage items are hardly fit to display in a home where girls and women are about.
I bristled with indignation. But this was more attention than a boy of Tom's age had ever paid me, and though I had weightier worries, I didn't want it to go badly. Papa doesn't agree.
I'm sure he doesn't. After all, your father thinks nothing of carrying you to Boston and back again, when you should be in the care of a woman to teach you domestic arts.
Red-hot anger straightened my spine at these words he must have heard spoken by his parents. Though my journey with Papa had been a terrifying blur of grief and long carriage rides and cobblestone streets, I met his smug gaze and boasted, "Not only Boston. We went to Philadelphia and Baltimore, too. And now I've seen all the states. Have you?" This proved to be an embarrassing mistake, for Tom quizzed me on all 13 newly independent states until it became apparent that I was woefully short of the full set. Moreover, my ignorant boast caused Tom to puff up and announce,
"Anyway, I've come to tell you that you'll take your supper with the children. I'll be dressing for dinner and sitting at the table with the other men, of course."
He wanted me to feel young and foolish, and I did. But more than that, he made me anxious that Papa and I should be apart even for the length of a supper. Leaving Tom, I found my father dressing for dinner, his manservant adjusting his cravat. When I told Papa what Tom said, he stared into the mirror, muttering,
"Patsy, try to get along with Tom. It isn't easy for him as the Colonel's heir apparent."
He said the last words with a hint of contempt, then added,
"The Randolphs like to make much of their pedigree, to which I suppose everyone else must ascribe whatever merit they choose."
Thus, banished to the lower-level kitchen where the children ate, I intended to sulk. It didn't quite work out that way when I fell into the company of the Randolph sisters. Judith was my age, and Nancy only a little younger, and by the time we'd taken our fill of egg custards and apple tarts and candied cherries, we were fast friends. Their companionship both eased the ache I felt for missing my sisters and worsened it. Before bed, Mrs. Randolph gathered us round her harpsichord in the richly appointed great hall, and the men drifted in with their brandy. Puffing on a pipe, Colonel Randolph said to Papa,
"It's fortunate your appointment to France came to nothing. You're better off in retirement. No good comes of public service anymore."
Ignoring the strained smile of his wife, whose expression seemed to warn him away from such talk, Colonel Randolph continued,
"I practically funded Washington's army myself, but I've been criticized by so-called patriots for the liberality with which I treated British soldiers."
Settling into one of the tasseled armchairs, Papa crossed one leg at the knee.
"We must endure criticism if we're to honor the spirit of independence."
Colonel Randolph's jowls reddened.
"The spirit of independence. Every man who bore arms in this revolution now considers himself on the same footing as his neighbor. I tell you, Jefferson, the spirit of independence has been converted to the abominable idea of equality."
Papa, who had declared to the world that all men are created equal, was long acquainted with Colonel Randolph's bluster, and merely drank in silence. And in irritation, Mrs. Randolph chirped, "Shall we have Judith play another song?" Alas, Colonel Randolph wouldn't be silenced.
"I won't serve again in the legislature, and you should follow my example, Jefferson."
Papa grimaced, contemplating the crystal goblet in his hand.
What else is left for me but public service when all my private happiness has been so utterly destroyed?
Colonel Randolph swallowed, and Mrs. Randolph fluttered her fan. In the astonished silence, Papa's cheeks reddened. He'd been goaded into expressing his darkest thoughts, and his embarrassment pained me like a hot stone in my belly. Some part of me had hoped the Randolphs would see my papa's devastation, that they'd realize he was a man on the edge of something terrible. But their silence was excruciating. Young Tom had been slumped in his chair, trying to affect an air of manly indifference. But now he perked up, sitting straighter.
"I'd like to serve in public office one day, Mr. Jefferson."
I didn't know if Tom blundered forth in self-interest or to ease the tension, but his question gave my father a moment to recover. His mother flashed him an adoring smile of appreciation, and the gratitude I felt toward Tom made me forget I'd ever disliked him.
"You'll need an education," Papa suggested. "You'll want to study law." "He'll study how to plant tobacco,"
Colonel Randolph barked.
"There's good reason gentlemen are withdrawing from public life, my friend. Retire to Monticello, plant your crops, and enjoy the fruits of your labor. That's my advice to you."
Despite the colonel's provocation, it seemed good advice to me. Certainly it was what Mama had wanted. And in the days that followed, I hoped Papa would be persuaded by it. But on the day the Randolph sisters coaxed me to play with them and their dollies in the springtime sunshine, Papa saw me laughing, and his gaze filled with an even deeper melancholy. That night, he didn't sleep. He paced the floors of his room, then came into mine. I think he knew I'd be awake. Gently brushing my hair from my face beneath my sleeping cap, he asked,
"Could you be happy here, Patsy, with the Randolphs?"
The question was mildly spoken, but his eyes had a mad intensity to them. Both sent my heart into a breath-stealing sprint. Was it a rebuke? Did he think I'd forgotten my mother? Did he consider my laughter a dishonor to her memory? My stomach knotted in guilt, and I bunched the quilt in my fists. No!
"The schoolhouse here," he said softly. "Your grandfather built it. Judith and Nancy are suitable playmates, and Tom might even make a good husband for you one day."
"No, Papa," I insisted, my fears rising. "I couldn't be happy here, not without you."
"You might be."
"It's not true, Papa." Now anger swirled with fear inside me, forcing me to cry. "I can only be happy with you."
"It's only that circumstances might take me elsewhere for a time."
He sighed with a gravity that made me recognize it as a plea. Even if he could hide it from the rest of the world, he couldn't hide from me his longing for death. It was in the spaces and silences between his words that the truth could be found. I heard it in what he didn't say, and I determined never to give him an excuse to take his leave of this world. "I'd be miserable here, Papa. I find the Randolphs entirely disagreeable. Wherever your duty takes you, it must take me too." For the memory of my mother could not be honored, my promises could not be kept, and my own duty could not be met anywhere else. Only when his shoulders sagged in resignation and he pressed a tender kiss to my brow did my heart finally calm within my chest. The next morning, I shied away from Judith and Nancy, instead following Mrs. Randolph past the schoolhouse into her orderly herb garden. There, in the striped linen short gown and straw hat she wore for gardening,
She let me help her tend the raspberry and sweet goldenrod she used to brew her liberty tea. I suppose now that the war is over, we'll drink the real stuff again. But my boy Tom has been kind enough to pretend he's fond of my concoction, and I dare say your father likes it, too.
The warm affection in her voice for her son and my father beckoned my trust. Should I tell her that Papa was unwell? Did I dare even hint at what he'd said the night before? Biting my lip, I debated what path was most right in a situation that was so very wrong. Finally, I stayed silent, knowing she wasn't the sort to involve herself in the business of men. Only someone like Colonel Randolph could make things right. And perhaps he tried in his own way. When the gentlemen took their ease under an awning on the back lawn, overlooking the James River, Papa sketched the gardens into a little leather book, and I climbed into his lap, where he encouraged me to nibble at the untouched biscuits on his plate. That's when Colonel Randolph said,
"Jefferson, if you stay longer, we'll organize a horse race to be followed by an evening of dancing. No doubt every pretty widow and unmarried girl in Virginia will want an invitation."
Papa's pencil stopped mid-stroke.
"No doubt."
Scowling after a gulp of his wife's liberty tea, Colonel Randolph added,
"Men like us weren't meant to live alone."
My father stiffened against my back, his whole body rigid and brittle. With awful clarity, I understood that Colonel Randolph was encouraging Papa to take a new wife. That was how he thought to help matters. He thought a new wife would keep Papa away from his pistols in the night, which meant that he didn't understand my father's grief at all, nor the promise that Papa had made at my mother's deathbed. My father quietly closed his sketchbook and excused himself with a litany of bland niceties. The next day, Papa announced our departure. I believe he'd finally realized there was nowhere else for us to go but home. But I was wrong. Annapolis, 28 November, 1783. From Thomas Jefferson to his dearest Patsy.
"The conviction that you'd be improved in the situation I've placed you solaces me in parting with you, which my love for you has rendered a difficult thing. Consider the good lady who has taken you under her roof as your mother, as the only person to whom, since the loss with which heaven has been pleased to afflict you, you can now look up. The acquirements I hope you'll make under the tutors I've provided will render you more worthy of my love, and if they cannot increase it, they'll prevent its diminution. I've placed my happiness on seeing you good and accomplished, and no distress this world can now bring on me could equal that of your disappointing my hopes."
On a cobblestone street of Philadelphia, sniffling into my sleeve like a little child, I pleaded, "But, Papa, why can't I stay with you?" I couldn't believe what was happening. We'd only been home long enough to pay a visit to my sisters at Eppington before Papa informed all of us that he'd been elected to Congress, and this time he meant to serve. Now he meant to leave me in Philadelphia with a Mrs. Hopkinson, a patriotic goodwife supposedly well known for her pious virtues. Had I convinced Papa not to leave me with family and friends, only to have him abandon me with strangers? I couldn't fathom why Papa would take me by horse and carriage, up bumpy roads and by ferry across treacherous rivers, only to part with me here. In truth, I cannot fathom his reasoning even now. A wind blew down the alley, howling between the narrow spaces that separated Mrs. Hopkinson's tall brick home from its neighbors, rattling the shutters, But my father didn't take it as a sign of foreboding. Instead, he explained,
Congress is sure to convene in Philadelphia or nearby, and we need to attend to your education. I won't be far from you day or night.
In this, he turned out to be wrong. Congress wasn't called to Philadelphia, where, in the Independence Hall, Papa's declaration had been signed 8 Julys before. Instead, because of a mutiny of Pennsylvania soldiers who hadn't been paid their wages from the war, Philadelphia was deemed unsafe for the legislators. So Congress was called to Annapolis, and 3 days later, Papa left for Maryland without me. All I knew, all I could see, was that I'd been abandoned in a huge, bustling city amongst strangers. At first, panic left me inconsolable upon my borrowed bed. Despair rushed in close behind, making me listless and sullen. I was sure that I'd never see my beloved Papa again. At least I'd said my goodbyes to Mama before she was taken from us. And she was taken. She hadn't left of her own accord. Not like Papa, who wanted to join her. My distress was such that I struggled to keep down the victuals Mrs. Hopkinson served at her table. She wasn't an unkind woman, but she urged me to pray for God's solace, and she prayed often, loudly. I had a bevy of exotic tutors. The French Mr. Senat, who taught dancing, the English Mr. Bentley, who taught music, the Swiss Mr. Simitier, who taught art, and a special tutor for the French language, too. But I didn't wish to learn anything. Without my sisters or my papa, I didn't even wish to rise from bed. My stomach pains worsened, but I feared Mrs. Hopkinson didn't believe me, for the only tonic she offered was a morning prayer. Prayers were not, however, on the schedule Papa wrote out for me, so I tried to devote myself to my studies, save for drawing, for which I had no capacity. Even Mr. Simitier said so, fervently and repeatedly. All my efforts ended in my nervous stomach emptying its contents into a bowl I held in filthy hands, smudges of graphite on my fingers and clothes. Someone must have reported this to Papa, for his next letter from Annapolis upbraided me for slovenliness.
"Let your clothes be clean, whole, and properly put on," he wrote, "for nothing is so disgusting to our sex as the want of cleanliness and delicacy in yours."
These were the harshest words Papa had ever put to me, and to see the reprimand written so starkly on paper, I gasped and clutched at my stomach, which again tossed with humiliation and upset. Mrs. Hopkinson pulled my trembling body against her sweaty bosom, trying to hush me. "Poor child, pray for an acquiescent spirit so that you obey your father's commands. Surely you know your papa does God's work, so we must relieve him of temporal worries." Her words echoed Mama's, and everyone in Philadelphia said that my papa was a great man, and that we must put before our own desires a worry for our new country. But wickedly, like Colonel Randolph, I no longer cared a fig for it. Instead, I burned with resentment, angrier with my father than I'd ever been. Papa wanted me to send him my drawings, but he didn't reply when I did. Indeed, it seemed there were a great many things that Papa wished from me, while none of my wishes mattered at all. So I wrote Papa only when he wrote to me. And when my drawing teacher couldn't recognize my sketch of Monticello as having any merit, I tore it to bits, prompting Mr. Simitier to quit his post. 6 months passed in Philadelphia. Christmas, the new year, winter, spring. It wasn't until May that Papa finally came to fetch me. I spied through the window the back of a tall man wearing an embroidered blue coat. And, as he made his way to the door,
I caught a glimpse of ginger hair beneath his black tricorn hat. I wanted to leap up from my chair and cry, "Papa!" But instead, I waited sullenly while the white-aproned matriarch of the household ushered my father inside. Though I was angry with him for having abandoned me, words could not express my relief at seeing my father again. While he thanked Mrs. Hopkinson for looking after me, my eyes hung on every detail of his features, looking for any evidence that time had wrought changes. The straight set of his spine and the animation of his blue eyes revealed that he was glad to see me, and it softened the hardest edges of my anger.
"How is my girl?"
Papa asked, opening his arms to me. I wanted to run to him, but it had been so long and I had been so scared that I held firm in my seat. When he saw that I would not be so easily wooed, he wryly took from his pocket 2 tickets to an exhibition of hot air balloons.
"I see an inducement is required. Come now, Patsy, let me show you a glorious thing."
Try as I might, I couldn't resist my papa. In truth, when he put his mind to charm someone, no one could. I rose slowly, but then I flew into his arms and buried my face against his coat. And that very hour, he took me to see the marvelous contraptions that harnessed heat and rendered the balloon lighter than air. That was how I felt, holding my papa's hand again. Watching the colorful balloons rise up, I thought I might float into the heavens. "Tell me we're going home again, Papa. Tell me we won't be apart any more." His clear eyes followed the balloons into the sky.
"I'm to be an envoy to Paris."
I crashed back down to earth, afraid I'd cry, right there in front of the crowd, shaming myself and Papa besides. "No, Papa, please." He gave my hand a small squeeze.
"I'm taking you with me. I've learned in these past months that I cannot do without your company. In truth, I am quite lost without it."
Gulping in breaths of relief, I hugged his arm tight. I never wanted to set foot in Mrs. Hopkinson's brick house again. I didn't even want to say goodbye. Thankfully, Papa sent Jimmy Hemmings to fetch my things from the boarding house. My father explained that Jimmy was coming with us to Paris to be trained in the art of French cookery so that when we returned to Monticello, we might entertain with the same grace we'd found at Tuckahoe. Those words were a balm to my soul, for they meant that Papa was thinking of a time when we would all live together at Monticello again, some day, even if he couldn't bear it now. The thought made me so glad that not even the jostling 3-week trip to Boston, where we traveled to catch our ship, dampened my excitement for this new shared adventure. And in the dawning hours of our nation's 8th birthday, we boarded the Ceres and set sail.
Chapter 5. Hartford, 11 October, 1784. To Thomas Jefferson from Lafayette.
"When I heard of your going to France, I lamented I couldn't have the honor to receive you there. My house, my family, and anything that is mine are entirely at your disposal, and I beg you will see Madame de Lafayette as you would your brother's wife. Indeed, I'd be very angry with you if you didn't consider my house as a second home, and Madame de Lafayette is very happy to wait upon Miss Jefferson."
Has there ever been such a labyrinthine city as Paris? Upon our arrival, we found sooty walls within muddy walls around the city proper, and beggars round every corner. But all the soot and mud gave way to beauty when, borne in a fine coach by 7 horses, we passed under a bright blue sky onto the wide avenue of the Champs-Élysées.
From there, the whole city fanned out before us in splendor. Stone archways, domes, and pillars all reached for the sun. In truth, the bustling seaports of Philadelphia, Boston, and Baltimore were mere infants in comparison to the ancient majesty of this grand city. I was giddy at the sight, and I wasn't the only one. Jimmy Hemmings removed his cap, thunderstruck, and Papa gasped when the proud Palais Royal came into view. The palace's expanse of creamy white bricks beyond ironwork gates was nearly too much to take in. I could never have imagined such a place. Overcome, I asked, "This palace belongs to the king." The word king elicited a frown from my father, but our coachman explained that the gardens were now open to the public, a thing we could plainly see as we turned a corner into the teeming crowds. Every man was ornamented in waistcoat and powdered wig, and the ladies wore their hair as tall as you pleased, strutting about like well-plumed songbirds. Every breeze carried a thousand voices in the melody of the French language. The breeze also carried the disagreeable smell of so many people crowded close together, but the sweet perfume of the gardens and the ribbons of bright green shrubbery winding in every direction made me forget all else.
"Oh, Papa, is this what heaven looks like?"
"If there be such a place, perhaps it is just so." There was a new light in his eyes. As his gaze slipped over the carved marble facades of the palace and its surrounding structures, the hard lines of his expression melted away into fascination. I hadn't seen him this engaged with the world since my mother died. And Paris was very much alive. Taking it in, Papa sat with his mouth set in an odd half-smile. I realized with a jolt that the shadow of grief seemed to have lifted from him. Could I dare to hope this momentous change I sensed was real? Unable to resist, I threaded my fingers through his. His hand, so often stiff and cold since my mother's death, closed warmly over mine. We stayed that night at a cheerful little inn. The next morning, Papa was up early to shop for wine and a map of the city, and to look for servants. He hired two men straight away. That afternoon, we were paid a visit by one Mr. Adams, a member of our delegation in Paris, and his wife, Abigail. What a relief it was to be in the company of Americans after even a few days of being surrounded by people who spoke only French. The stout Mr. Adams greeted my father with the warmest friendship. It was Mrs. Adams, however, who commanded our attention. In a gray gown with few ruffles at the sleeves, she rolled into the room like a summer storm. "Oh, poor Mr. Jefferson! I've seen the new house you intend to lease, and it's even emptier of furnishings than ours. There is no table better than an oak board, nor even a carpet."
"We'll have to shop for furnishings," Papa allowed.
Mrs. Adams beat back the hotel draperies for dust. "You'll also need table linen, bed linen, china, glass, and plate. Our own house is much larger than we need. 40 beds may be made in it. It must be very cold in winter. With a smaller abode, you'll have the advantage." She wasn't an elegant woman, Mrs. Adams, nor was she deferential in the way Papa taught me good women must be. I looked to him for signs of disapproval, but when it came to Abigail Adams, he wasn't able to muster it.
"I won't need many beds," he said. "There will only be me and my daughter and a few servants, and, of course, my secretary, Mr. Short, when he arrives."
I hadn't heard Mr. Short's name in quite some time, not since my fall from the horse when he chastised Papa. The mention now was a pleasant surprise, almost as pleasant as learning that Mr. Short would be joining us here in Paris. As I absorbed the happy news,
Mrs. Adams turned her gaze to me.
You must be your father's dear Patsy.
Then her dark eyes narrowed over a beak of a nose when she saw the stain upon my calico dress. She looked me up and down, and when she reached my feet, I wiggled my toes nervously in worn shoes. Mrs. Adams spun to face my father.
Oh, dear. Oh, no. This will never do. Your daughter can't set foot in Paris looking like this.
How provoking. She made me sound like an urchin. My father looked positively mortified, and Mr. Adams grumbled. Immune to our general discomfort, his wife continued.
For that matter, Mr. Jefferson, it might be well for you to have some new clothes made, too. We Americans must represent ourselves well, and you've no idea how these Parisians worship fashion. Why, to be out of fashion is more criminal than to be seen in a state of nature, to which the Parisians are not averse.
I blushed, and so did my papa, but I didn't think it was the mention of Parisians in the state of nature that embarrassed him most. He looked down at his own waistcoat, self-consciously fingering one of the loose fastenings.
Is there no advantage to remaining uncorrupted by sophistication?
Mrs. Adams smirked, but insisted with an innate sense of authority. You must send immediately for the staymaker, the mantua maker, the milliner, and even a shoemaker. In a few hours, merchants of every variety overran our quarters, and Mrs. Adams marshaled them this way and that, lecturing my father on the cost. I could have furnished myself in Boston 20 or 30% cheaper than I've been able to do here. I cannot get a dozen handsome wine glasses under 3 guineas, nor a pair of small decanters for less than 1.5 guineas. When the dressmaker arrived, Papa allowed the garrulous Mrs. Adams to herd me upstairs. Poor motherless girl. We'll get you in proper order straight away. It was a comedy after that, for the dressmaker knew only a little English, and neither Mrs. Adams nor I spoke French very well. My apprehension grew when the dressmaker's assistant displayed bolts of cloth for our perusal. Mrs. Adams asked my favorite color, and looking at the samples before me, I hesitated, afraid to give the wrong answer. I'd never been good at keeping my clothes tidy, so I hoped to choose something that might hide the stains.
The blue silk would suit you, Mrs. Adams said, then seemed to reach into my thoughts and snatch them from the air. Girls keep their clothes tidier if you let them choose the colors and fabrics they like.
Under her expectant gaze, I tentatively asserted myself.
I am fond of the blue, but yellow, too.
Mrs. Adams nodded.
A lovely combination. Perhaps a pale yellow petticoat beneath the blue silk, and some yellow bows on the sleeves.
With hand motions, Mrs. Adams made the dressmaker understand. Assistants rushed in with a dizzying array of shiny ribbons and frothy lace. Meanwhile, Mrs. Adams looked through my trunks, quite uninvited.
You're nearly 12?
I nodded.
Then you'll need a new wardrobe entirely. We can't get it all done today, but I'll draw up a list.
She said I was to have shoes with decorative buckles and bonnets with flowers. I was to have new undergarments and a side-hooped petticoat to give me the illusion of hips in the case of a very formal occasion. I was to have a cape and handkerchiefs, and maybe even a chemise gown of pure white muslin, like the kind made popular by the French queen. I was to have at least one gown immediately, made of the scraps and bits that the dressmaker sent her assistant to fetch, so that I could go out into proper company while the other dresses were being made. Standing in the middle of the whirlwind as the seamstress took measurements, I was shy of the attention. But Mrs. Adams encouraged me to stand up straight.
You're going to be tall like your father. There's no help for it. Still, your red hair is lovely, and your soulful eyes are sure to be some man's undoing, so never shrink down into yourself.
Her direct manner might have been off-putting, but I perceived a compliment. Maybe two. My thanks, Mrs. Adams. But you're sure Papa will consent to the expense for my clothes?
At this, Mrs. Adams softened.
What a sweet girl you are to worry. The truth is, you'll have to help your father make do. The policy of our country has been and still is to be penny-wise and pound-foolish. The nation which degrades their own foreign ministers by obliging them to live in narrow circumstances cannot expect to be held in high esteem. Here in Paris, my dear, appearances are indispensable. I liked that she didn't speak in the falsetto voice some adults do with children. She talked of grown-up concerns as if I was old enough to understand. She was too loquacious to remind me of my own mother, but I felt mothered as I hadn't been in years. Though Mrs. Adams offered very firm guidance, she didn't bully me. When the friseur came, and I declined to have my hair styled in the high plume of fashionable Parisian women, Mrs. Adams said that I should have my own way, and I left my copper ringlets down, tied in a simple ribbon. Eventually, the dressmaker's assistant returned with a gown of lilac satin that had been discarded by some other girl. I was virtually sewn into the dress on the spot. When the seamstress was finished, I stroked the fabric, which was soft as peach skin. I'd never owned anything so lovely. Excitement fluttered in my belly that the dresses made for me would be even prettier. In my new gown of draped sleeves, I scarcely recognized myself in the mirror. Indeed, I preened so long that I feared Mrs. Adams would think me vain. But I no longer appeared to be the rustic girl I knew. Abigail ushered me into the parlor, where we found Papa with a book in his hands, pointing something out to Mr. Adams. "May I present Miss Martha Jefferson?" Abigail said, clearly pleased. Papa glanced up, his eyes widening.
"Why, Miss Jefferson, you have become a miniature lady."
He looked to Abigail.
"I thank and congratulate you, madam."
He pressed his hand to his mouth and shook his head.
Plainly, a woman's touch was just what was needed.
Perhaps not sensing the sadness I heard in his voice, Mrs. Adams clasped her hands and gave a self-satisfied smile. "Indeed." Their praise made my cheeks heat. But I enjoyed Papa's astonishment so much that I didn't mind the attention, especially when, after Mrs. Adams left, Papa turned to me once more.
"Let me see you," he said. "Spin round."
Like a dancer, I held out my arms and twirled, the long skirt swishing around me, and Papa smiled. The first open smile I'd seen in so very long. I was afraid to pinch myself for fear that I'd wake up in Philadelphia, alone and afraid. But no, I was awake, and I dared to hope that the charms of the old world had awakened us both from our nightmare of grief and madness at last. Papa's French friends, who had helped us during the Revolution, were also eager to get us settled. In fact, it was the Marquis de Chastellux who arranged for my enrollment at the Abbaye Royale de Pentemont, a convent school where two of the French princesses took their education. Fearful of being boarded with strangers yet again, I pleaded, "Can't I have tutors? I promise to attend my studies. I want to stay with you, Papa." I was grown now, old enough to help set up his household. If Papa believed, as he said he did, that young girls ought to primarily be trained for domestic tasks, to prepare for a life as wives and mothers, then why did he insist on my learning music, drawing, arithmetic, geography, and Latin? But Papa would not be dissuaded in his plans for my education.
Even when my enrollment in the convent was universally criticized by our American friends, who feared royal and papist influences. The abbess swore, however, that though I would be cloistered behind convent walls during the week, I'd be exempt from catechism and the sacraments. As the day I was to attend the new school dawned, I could scarcely force myself from bed, despite the fact that I'd hardly slept all the night before. Papa had to call for me twice, and I was so distraught at our inevitable separation that I didn't even care that my delays earned his ire. When we finally passed through the gates of the Panthéon, underneath a magnificent clock that faced the street, I clung to my father's arm. In habits, the nuns all looked much the same, rushing about with their charges, girls wearing uniforms of crimson. We were led into a large room filled with beds and writing tables where I was to board with other girls. And though some of the girls were introduced to me as the daughters of English nobility, none would speak anything but French. I thought I was the only American. And when Papa left me for the night, I cried into my pillow, hoping no one could hear. Today, if someone were to ask where I have been happiest in my life, where I found the most companionship and joy and discovered the best in myself, I would name the convent without hesitation. But my first days at the Panthéon were a misery. I lived for the evenings when Papa came to share supper with me. Every night I thought he'd change his mind and take me home, but he didn't. I kept quietly to the corners, ignoring the taunts of the older girls. They pointed and laughed at my freckles and my big bony elbows. They mocked my faltering attempts to speak French. And I learned that I wasn't the only American girl after all. There was also Kitty Church, whose mother was from New York, but she seemed to despise me most of all. A kindly abbot encouraged me to play with the other girls in the courtyard during the afternoon, but when I cleaved to him, Kitty teased me that Catholic priests couldn't marry, which made me blush so hotly I could scarcely bear it. Learning embroidery one day, I was asked by one of the girls, "Is it true that your father owns African slaves?" The question was softly put, with no hint of malice. But before I could answer, Kitty Church laughed. "Yes, of course it's true. Don't you know that Mr. Jefferson is our slave-holding spokesman for freedom?" The way Kitty spoke of my father, with such mockery, stung my cheeks with shame. It was a shame deepened by the fact that Kitty's father, like mine, was an American envoy to France. Her family hailed from the North, where slaves were fewer and the abolitionists held much sway. I couldn't help but wonder if she'd learned this scorn for my father from hers, and if her father was a rival to mine. "Do you own a slave, Patsy?" Kitty sing-songed the question. "Do you whip her when she misbehaves?" This boldness encouraged our classmates, many of whom expressed dismay and made a point to tell me French law freed any slave who set foot in the country. I wondered if my father or Jimmy Hemmings knew this. And while I fumbled for a reply, mortified and defensive, one of the girls stabbed a needle into her embroidery before berating Kitty Church on my behalf, hurling curses in French. The savage-tempered girl was raven-haired and tiny, and I wondered why she took up for me. "It isn't how you say it is," I finally argued as the girls outdid one another in imagining horrid abuses. I remembered the day Papa commanded our overseer to stay his hand with the lash. I'd never witnessed slaves being whipped bloody or flayed open and left to wild animals if they disobeyed. Never had such a thing happened at Monticello. But the more I tried to defend our plantation, our home, our way of life, the more strident the criticisms became, and the nuns said nothing, for this was a house of pity, and they must have thought my papa a wretched sinner. I stared down at my crude embroidery, remembering my mother's sewing, her neat stitches to repair a dress in need of mending, a small embroidered flourish to ornament a bonnet or a tablecloth. In a dark mood, I was lost in that memory, until I looked down to see that I'd stabbed my finger with the needle, and my blood had seeped into the delicate cloth. "Come," said the raven-haired French girl. "We'll bandage that." Before I could protest, she shook her head and pressed her fingers to her lips to hush me. She was delicate and beautiful like my little sister Polly. That's what made me follow her back to the bedroom, where she sat beside me until I could face the world again. Her name was Marie de Beautidieu, but she couldn't say my name. The closest she came was Jiffy. I liked the way it sounded on her tongue, and I was so desperate for a friend, I would have let her call me anything at all. The next afternoon, the nuns made me draw in the parlor, imagining it to be some comfort to me, but I struggled with drawing as I always had, my lines curving sadly down at each end, my strokes too bold on the paper, smudges on my fingers and clothes. It was in this state that my visitor found me. Deep in melancholy, I looked up slowly, believing that my eyes deceived me. Could it be William Short, clutching at his hat? I was so glad to see him that I rushed to embrace him with the exuberance of a Frenchwoman. "Mr. Short, have you seen my papa?" He gave a quick bow of his head.
"The very reason for my visit, Patsy. Your father suffers of fever. He'll be confined to his house for some days. I know you are apt to worry, so I thought to convey his warmest regards myself."
I was unbearably grateful. He had seen us the day I was thrown from Caractacus. He understood as no one else did. He knew why I worried for Papa. But these were things that couldn't be spoken aloud. My lower lip trembled, and he must have seen it, for his eyes softened, and he reached for my hand.
"Poor child. If it will comfort you, I'll report to you on your father's health every few days."
The warmth and strength of his hand surprised me as much as steadied me. As his thumb slipped over my knuckle, I blinked up at him, reassured by the amiable smile on his well-bred, handsome face. For a moment, I couldn't help but study him, the only person who even knew a hint of my struggle with Papa. William Short's countenance appeared more angular, more masculine, less boyish than it had been years before. He carried himself with a new confidence, too. One that made me glad he'd be serving at Papa's side.
"Thank you, of course, but can't I go to him, Mr. Short?"
"Don't fret, Patsy. The thing that will best ensure his comfort and well-being is to know that you're well cared for and thriving at your studies. If I can reassure him of this, he'll rest easier."
Alas, I had presented myself in precisely the way that most vexed Papa. I'd received his new secretary in a slovenly state, smudging his hand with pencil dust.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Short. I've dirtied your hand."
He looked down and chuckled at the sight of my blackened fingers, the graphite smearing into the lines of his palm.
"So you have."
Then mischief lit in his eyes, as he reached to playfully smudge my nose with his thumb. I giggled, which attracted the attention of sour-faced nuns. They scolded me, eyeing my green-eyed, sandy-haired visitor with a mixture of enchantment and disapproval. In French, I told them Mr. Short was a kinsman of my mother and as close to a son as my father had. one hand pressing to his chest. Mr. Short startled at my diction.
I envy you, Patsy, for your French is so improved. I've been struggling to learn it. But now I have the solution. I'll join the convent and live with you and all these pretty girls. So